last week, I gave a talk that I felt was kind of rambling and maybe a bit of a downer. So I had some doubt about it afterward. But then people came up and were like, "Oh, that was so useful." So who knows? Maybe a bit of both. But I've been wanting to speak to somehow how contemplative practice, as it's come from the Asian traditions to the West, meets the kind of the fierce complexity of the world that it's landing in here and now. And last week, I asked questions like, you know, does our practice really work? And is it working enough? And, you know, are Western Buddhism and yoga, have they actually arrived in these transplant countries with enough of their roots intact that they actually still offer a path to full liberation? Or do they offer a kind of diluted path to what I probably said something snarky about, you know, giving us just enough tools to feel a teensy bit better in the middle of industrial capitalism, something like that. And what I feel like I want to move toward in opening up that doorway is to ask some questions about and look at some of the roots, in a way, of, I'll say our practice, but that's a little meaningless. Everyone in my spiritual worlds, you know, practices something kind of a little different. You know, there's so many lineages of Asian practice here, and then indigenous Western practice from all over, and then how few people do I know whose primary spiritual practice is in the tradition they were raised in their families? So then there's very often this kind of layering of traditions that I'm kind of a, you know, I'm kind of a Catholic Buddhist bhakti yogi who's done a fair amount of like kind of indigenous and also crossover shamanic practice from all sorts of places. And I'm like, what is that? I don't even know what that is. And so many people I know are like that. This is totally a California Bay Area Dharma talk. This is not the case some other places. And even within my, you know, folks who are like, oh, I'm a Buddhist practitioner. Almost all the Buddhist practitioners I know of, you know, spend some bulk of their time in one tradition like Theravada or insight meditation or Zen or something, but then also have teachers from the Tibetan or from the Tibetan shamanic or from the, you know, and then do yoga, you know, and have an appreciation for Hanuman or for High Shaiva Tantra or, you know, and so... So there's not even an hour practice to comment on or critique. And I know that that's largely true, and it makes the conversation more difficult. If we want to look at Western yogic practice, and I'll just sort of use the word yogic to cover the Asian origin contemplative arts in the mix that they may be, for instance, here in the room. What I want to lean into is that throughout the history of these practices and as they've come to the West, they've retained in most incarnations that I know of an orientation toward what we can call liberation or freedom or realization or enlightenment, and different lineages and traditions define that very different ways. But very common in the definition in the Buddhist and Hindu yoga streams is the sense that in our ordinary life, there's an unhappiness or a dissatisfaction that's pervasive. And that seems to be built into the fabric of everything that we do. You know, that it's just the case that, you know, governments are going to be corrupt and relationships will get broken and bodies will get broken and lost to old age and violence and war, etc., and death. And all of the religions, you know, try to in some ways reassure us somehow what we could do or feel in relation to this. You know, whether that's that a certain pattern of action or belief in this life would lead to a future stability in heaven, or God forbid the other option, as a future stability, a future painful stability. That's a threat in some traditions. That was a threat in the tradition I grew up in. Buddhism and Hindu yoga both propose that this situation of suffering and its possible end are not to be found in the attainment of a heaven realm, but in the unbinding of something in our own hearts, a shift in our own way of being. That you know, as far as I know, you're all like familiar with aspects of that teaching. You know, one early Buddhist version of it is that we are dissatisfied because we constantly grasp at objects and relationships and experiences, thinking that they will provide us a lasting happiness when they can't by their nature. You know, we think that a relationship will be, this is unconscious, all of it, you know, that it'll be the cause for permanent satisfaction when, you know, relationships fluctuate like anything, and they can't be permanent, and therefore they can't be the cause of permanent satisfaction. But we chase rest or refuge, but we chase it in all the wrong places. And so then the path to liberation in the yogic systems is to figure out how to not do that, and how to do something else, how to orient toward that which could actually give us a permanent satisfaction, or in the way that we chant at the beginning of practice, a more reliable refuge. So, a moment of Buddhist history. In the earliest layer that we have access to, it seems like the practice that that Gautama, the Buddha, offered was offered to a mix of lay people and monastics, but he was centered in the monastic system, and the practice was a series of renunciation-oriented reflections on existence. Reflections like, everything changes, so why try to hold on to it? And I can't find a thing to call myself, so maybe I should just let go of that idea. And no particular thing seems like it'll cause me, like it'll be the cause of permanent satisfaction. What happens if I don't look at things for that? And these reflections, you know, played out as a set of quite refined reflections on the nature of the body and experience. You know, it says, analyze your body in terms of you know, five great elements. Rather than being like, oh, this is my body, it's young, it's pretty, it's getting old, it's not so pretty, it hurts, it feels good. All of these things that have, you know, story and identity wrapped up in them. The early system says, check it out. Pressure and texture, that's the earth element. And cohesion and liquidity, that's water. And temperature, hot and cold, is fire. And movement of any kind is wind. And the perception of distance between things is space. And folks, that's all that's happening. And you can put on that lens, the practice of the elements, and you could see everything. The movement of my hand in space, and the taste of the tea, and the sense of being alive in this moment, I can reduce down to this, I can analyze down to this very simple, fundamental structure. And there are several of those offered, right? You could use the senses as a reflection in that way. And some of the very earliest practices very likely were things like the reflection on the body as a corpse, where you would visualize, or if you have the fortune to, I don't know if it's good fortune for you, but if you were that kind of renunciate, the good fortune to have access to a cemetery where bodies were just left out to rot or get burned. But the meditation is on rotting, where you would observe a corpse in the stages of decomposition, and the text lists them in gory detail. And the meditation is to see the body in this profound detail, you know. Here's a body freshly dead, bloated, beginning to fester. Here's a body several days dead, the fester's having popped and it's oozing. And it's like really goes through the process of a body decomposing all the way to, you know, here's scattered bones broken apart, ligaments gone, becoming dust. And with every one of these layers, the reflection is, you know, my body too will do this. This is inevitable for this body. And this early layer of reflections is the seed of what we call mindfulness practice now. Mindfulness is rooted in this earliest layer, and it very likely meant originally something like remember these teachings and these reflections. Keep your mind attentive to them the way that your mind is attentive when you're remembering something. So attention connects with something. That's remembering or bringing the attention to it, or being mindful of something. And the goal in all of these reflections is to unhook our heart-mind from mistaken perceptions about who we are, and that when we unhook in that way, then we naturally won't grasp, because we've seen through the object of grasping, or the fiction, the fantasy we were grasping at. I grasp at the body staying healthy, but you know, I do a little practice and I realize that that just doesn't sustain, maybe for a teeny bit, but it's changing all the time. And once I get to know the inevitability of old age, sickness, and death, and the unreliability of the body, then I just live in it differently. I inhabit it differently. All the way to the thing that the Buddha pointed toward, that he called the deathless, really attaining what we might think of in sort of ordinary language as being completely free of the fear of death and loss. Really understanding death and loss in a profoundly deep way, such that there's no perception of it's not no perception of loss, because there is the perception of loss. It's like there's no it's almost like there's no perception that it's a tragedy, right? It's that the ecosystem does what ecosystems do. We are animals in an ecosystem embedded in nature, and we are nature, we do what nature does. And if we could really get that, we would live, as the Buddha said, unencumbered and free with our minds like wild deer, is the way he described his own consciousness. With my mind like a wild deer, he said, untroubled in a very deep way. And so with this as this foundation, like, that's beautiful, and you might be inspired by that. But that's also a description of a kind of practice that I don't know that many people doing in a kind of direct or literal fullness. I know folks that do all of those practices, and lay folks, both lay folks and monastics. But very often, for many of us, the monastic system is you know, is barely established in the West at all. Like you probably don't know that many monks or nuns in Buddhist or yogic systems. You might know a few, but there aren't that many to know here. Unlike in many of the Asian cultures where, you know, if you got attracted to these kind of teachings, you could go and fully renounce grasping onto anything like family or property or, you know, doing any engagement in civic life in favor of pursuing these practices very fully and then existing in the community in a different way. And there's a whole role in the community for the monastics who don't disappear out of, you know, the life of the community, but actually the community just is divided between monastics and lay people, and there's lots of both of them around all the time. And it's sort of like there's two ways to live. And in one way, you own stuff, and you make money, and you have sex and children, and keep the flow of resources going. And in the other, you let go of doing that stuff in order to look more deeply at existence. And you do that for the sake of everyone. And society consists of a kind of balanced set of communities. And perhaps in the early ideal, this is what it was like. And in some, you know, in some countries, and not very many, you know, but Burma was like this for a while. Sri Lanka and Thailand were like this for a while. China and Japan, somewhat less so, but certainly vast monastic orders in those countries. Tibet, probably our clearest modern example of that. And modern is sort of in quotes, since it kind of stayed a medieval society till 1958, more or less. And then in this kind of cataclysm, this medieval, feudal, religion-based society with the monastics at the center, was suddenly a culture in resistance against an invading force, and Tibet was really simply destroyed by that encounter. The strange result of that was Tibetan Buddhism has now been preserved forever because it had to go into diaspora, and it met the full force of modern text preservation and scholarship, and suddenly it's a different thing than it was before. But there have been these cultures where the monastic system, the renunciate orders, and the lay system were quite balanced. It's not the case here. And so these practices exist, but who are we practicing them? And, you know, what would become of your life if you took this really personally? What would become of your life if you began to, you know, do the corpse reflections and the deconstructing the body reflections and really took seriously the letting go of all the threads of identity that the contemplative side of yogic practice suggests? And mostly I want to propose that we don't have a very good foundation here for that. You might not be very well held by your communities, partly because not that many people are doing that. Right? And for many of us, you know, if you come back from retreat where you've gone deeply into practice and you try to talk to your friends or your family about what you experienced, there's very often a gulf to cross to even communicate that, you know, the standard instruction we give at the end of retreat is to tell people when they say, like, how was your retreat? The right answer is, great. Because to say anything more actually requires footnotes, you know, requires like some understanding being shared of what you were doing there and what it might mean to undertake practices like this. So all of this is a little bit as background. Now that's been most of the talk on background. What I wanted to go toward is that there was this huge turning then in Buddhism particularly, and a little bit later in the Hindu systems, but it happened in interesting ways in parallel in both, where the monastic system was decentralized and lay people's practice was elevated. And we often think of this in Buddhism in terms of what's called the Mahayana, the great vehicle. It starts to arise around the first century or so CE. And it's more of a layperson's practice. It's not as focused on the monks. And it develops a whole new body of teachings. And I want to speak to that body of teachings over the next bunch of weeks in some different ways. Because I want to feel together and ask some of these questions about, like, not so much what does our practice look like, because we're all sort of finding our own way in idiosyncratic ways, but what could Western convert Asian contemplative practice look like if we were really oriented toward full liberation? That's a question. The question is already tilted, because in a strange way, I say it's strange, just historically, I think it's strange, but it makes sense with who we are. There are whole segments of Western Buddhism and yoga that don't even believe in liberation. There's a whole discourse that actually rejects the idea that there is a kind of state or realization that Buddhas or Mahasiddhas or Vidyadharas or whatever word you call them, sages, abide in. And this rejection, I feel like it has some roots in the same kind of approach that has given rise to, like, new atheism and kind of resurgence in, like a kind of materialist pushback against religions of all kinds. But it's interesting that there are whole realms of Buddhism and yoga that come from liberation-oriented traditions that essentially say something like orienting toward liberation is either doesn't feel right for me personally. That's the one I feel here most commonly, or with an implication of, and not as many people say this, but I feel like it's implied, and some people will say it, that orientation toward liberation actually isn't even appropriate for the times that we're in. Like, people shouldn't be oriented toward that. Most often what I hear is folks saying, you know, I'm interested in deepening in my relationships, living in my life more fully, using these practices to heal, you know, emotional or psychological or relational wounding, and to be more fully myself in some way. And this is a beautiful motivation. And in a way, part of what I think we can do, again, we in sort of weird quotation marks, whoever we is, as Western practitioners, really just like kind of maybe three generations into the Dharma coming to the West in a more broad way. So it's quite young here. One of the things we can do is we could enunciate the details of that motivation more clearly. Like, what does it mean to be oriented toward a kind of imminent well-being in this very life that is not liberation-oriented? And would that actually change? I think it does change which teachings we are drawn to, what practices we do. And it might mean that some of the traditional practices we don't do. I think this happens sort of on its own. Like, how many of you are enthusiastically doing the corpse reflections right now, you know, in your home practice? Not so many. So it happens naturally, but I think we could enunciate that more. Because one of the things that I think is an important hinge for how we practice, that becomes one of the things most emphasized in the Mahayana as it arises, is our motivation for practice. So now that I spent the whole time working toward saying that, which was going to be the topic tonight, I'll say it, and then we'll continue next week with motivation. I'll talk about bodhicitta next week. But in the Mahayana systems, rather than deconstructing experience in order to find liberation by, you know, unbinding the causes of suffering That was the early idea. What practice becomes in this new turning, it's called the second turning of the wheel of the Dharma, practice becomes oriented around a vow that practitioners would take. And this is a version of what we would now call like a bodhisattva vow. Bodhisattva becomes the name for the practitioners in this system. Bodhi, awakening, sattva, being, so beings devoted to awakening. One becomes a bodhisattva when one makes a vow to attain full liberation for the sake of others. And so it's an empathic or projective, in a certain way, vow. And it shows up in different ways. One of the earlier sort of mythic ways it shows up is this strange sort of image that the bodhisattva vows to not enter full liberation until everyone else has gone first. Some people joke about this as like, you know, a whole mess of bodhisattvas crowded around a doorway and they're all like, no, after you, no, after you. But one of the earliest ways that this shows up is in this idea that one makes a vow to attain Buddhahood. So not individual liberation, which is sort of like, you know, like, ah, I solved my own suffering. I was able to let go completely. Like, see ya. And I just dissolve into nirvana, like a flame going out. And I'm no longer reborn. That's the early idea. Then the bodhisattvas came in and they said, oh, actually, that's very small. The large way, the Mahayana, the great vehicle, is to say, I actually vow to get continually reborn until I don't just liberate myself, but I generate the qualities necessary to liberate countless other beings, which is what Buddhas themselves can do. And to do this, I have to be reborn for innumerable eons, generating these perfections of the heart called parami or paramita. We talked about them as a list last year sometime. Generosity and kindness and wisdom and renunciation and patience, etc. And this turns into the practice of motivation as being central to the path. And one's motivation wasn't that central in the early system. It was really just like, you know, you want to be free from suffering, that's your motivation. Go for it. Like, here's the instructions, do it. In the later system, this becomes a quality that one should generate for, like, over and over as part of your practice, the wish to save all beings. And we won't get to this tonight, but we'll talk about it over the weeks. Mahayana texts and teachers do this marvelous and subtle maneuver then, you know, that goes something like this. We already know from the early system that identity is a fiction, in a way, that everything is interconnected, and that there wasn't actually a solid personal self here to begin with. We then take that teaching and we abstract it to the wisdom that everything is like that. So nothing is intrinsically itself. Everything is vastly interconnected. And another word for that is empty. Empty of inherent nature. Don't worry about that if that's new to you, but we'll get there. It's an empty shunya or shunyata of self-nature, svabhava, or inherent existence. And if that's the case, then there's no such thing as beings to be saved. Right? Here I am, a bodhisattva. I vow to save all beings. That includes y'all. But of course, I can't be a bodhisattva if I'm still clinging to the idea that there is such a thing as separate individuals, because that's so old system. That's so pre-awakened. So a bodhisattva that thinks that there is such a thing as beings to be saved isn't a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva vows to attain Buddhahood, even though that bodhisattva knows that there is no such thing as Buddhahood to be attained. And there's no path to get there. And so then the texts have these marvelous conversations in them where, you know, one bodhisattva says to another, you know, O Subhuti, Subhuti is one of the bodhisattvas, it's his name. O Subhuti, when the Tathagata, which is the name for the Buddha, it means the one thus gone, when the Tathagata attained perfect, unexcelled, full enlightenment, what was thereby attained? And Subhuti says, nothing was thereby attained, right? Because no one could attain that thing, because there was no one to attain it. In fact, nothing happened at all. And the Buddha, who's nearby, the Tathagata praises, he's well said, Subhuti, well said. In fact, there is nothing at all. And this is the flavor of these early texts. So then here's this crazy, beautiful paradox. And then I want to hear what you think about this. This system arises when lay people like us rebel a little bit against the idea that the monastic radical renunciate path is the only path to liberation. And sages start to come up with these teachings that one can both practice as a lay person without giving everything up because it's empty anyway. And this is the seed of later tantra. And that then the motivation to save others could be the heart of your practice. And this in itself, this is beautiful in a certain way. If we think about lay people, if the definition of lay people is that you're more engaged or more connected to others, then yeah, here's the heart of lay person's practice is it's relational. You're actually in it, not just for yourself anymore. You're not renouncing the family. You're still embedded in it. So you make the vow to save everyone. But then you practice remembering that there's no such thing. Yeah? And this becomes the heart of practice, continually vowing to understand in a kind of identity exploding way that everything is so interconnected that there's not even such a thing as liberation anymore. And that when you fully realize that thing that was already true, you have then done the activity of saving all beings. Does that make sense at all? No, right? So then it shouldn't, right? So then the early texts say, they say, how will we know these bodhisattvas when they show up? And the text says, a bodhisattva is one who is not afraid when hearing this teaching, who doesn't somehow wilt when hearing this radical kind of emptiness teaching. So that's the arc of the Mahayana, of the early Mahayana. This is the Prajnaparamita texts that I'm speaking to. This is partly in preparation for recording a course on the Heart Sutra, so I'll talk a bunch about that over the next bunch of weeks. But the piece that I want to land with and then talk about together is this thing about motivation. I talked a little bit last week about goal, and let's take a moment now with all of that as sort of background, the historical background, and a kind of, you know, practice lineages background. Take a moment and see if you can sense in yourself something like what the fuel is that keeps your practice going. What would you say is like your motivation? And it's different from your goal, right? There's a thing I'm trying to get toward, and then there's there's the energy that keeps me going, and the motivation is part of that energy. It's connected to a goal. I want to get somewhere. But I might not even know where that is, but there still might be an urge. But motivation is like the thing that, a quality in the heart that makes me actually want to be here, to investigate, to inquire, to practice, to search. You might not be able to describe it, but take a moment and see if you can sense that quality in yourself as a kind of energy. Sometimes you might feel it as a kind of urge or a pressure or a force that has maybe some emotional quality to it. But any descriptions? Anyone want to say what comes when you orient toward your motivation in practice, or what draws you forward in your practice? What do you find?
I think that for me, I've had mixed range of motivations. It starts with pretty selfish pleasure.
Yeah.
And yeah. It goes out to feeling grateful that I have that awareness of my thoughts being outside my physical media.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a great motivation just to listen and understand that there is a really critical mass of that people.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
That's a belonging motivation too.
Nice. I like hearing that. Yeah, I think it's true for a lot of us that sometimes the first motivation, and not as a lesser thing, but sometimes maybe the foundation, is a kind of, you know, use the word selfish. I would use that word also, you know. Like first I just want to feel okay, and then layers build upon that. What are your thoughts? Anything else you sense? What do you find? Yeah.
It's hard to describe, but I was kind of feeling into that. And this is like so abstract, but this is what it feels like. I just had the sense that it feels like the ground.
Like the ground.
Or like it feels like this, like, even though there's like a pressure or a longing, I feel that there's like this stability.
Hmm. Yeah. Sounds pleasurable. I like that.
Yeah.
As you say it, I kind of sink into myself a little bit. I'm like, oh, right, that. You get a sense, yeah. Ground. What else?
There are parts of the Dharma and parts of my experience today that feel the, like, images lining up, like there's clarity.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's what it was.
Mm.
It's almost like a recognition.
Yeah.
Or like a tone that's, like a true tone.
Yeah.
Or something. Like ringing like a bell almost.
Mm-hmm.
And those are sort of, it's not all of it, and it's not always, but there are those moments and those pieces of the teachings where I'm just like, oh, right.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what keeps me coming back, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then the second question might be something like, a little bit coming off of what Orly started with. You know, historically there's this conversation that happens between folks, you know, essentially saying that that liberation is primarily individual or internal to the individual. Even if we recognize that individuals are an illusion, it's the sense that this individual body has old age, sickness, and death, or you know, has a nervous system that's afraid or anxious. It's those qualities that need to be healed. Therefore, liberation is individual, even if it's the individual realizing that everything is empty. And then there's this other crew saying, what if we take that emptiness as the sort of the ground, and then liberation actually, from the very beginning, even from its motivation, is not individual, but a kind of collective thing. And I think I see often in practitioners that these two, and again, I'm really unnaturally separating them, like they very often are quite interwoven, but these two ways of understanding who we are in contemplative or spiritual practice, liberation practice, either stack on top of each other or interweave in different ways. Like we start off trying to find some kind of personal healing, and as soon as we get a little bit less miserable, our life naturally is opening to others and wanting to serve, and that seems very natural. So then there's something in our practice around, like, how do you weave between practice being a kind of balm for your own soul and being all, even in that, rooted in some way that you want to be in connection with the whole, whatever that is. Yeah? And then there's tension between those. If you go very substantially into different kinds of service or different kinds of formal practice, it can strongly weight in one direction or another. If you go on a very long solo retreat versus, you know, doing a long, like doing a project out in the world that keeps you directly engaged. How do you hold the idea of the felt sense of liberation, or what could be liberated in your practice, between the sense of the individual and the collective being affected by what you do?
So my reflection on this and the question before about motivation are a couple of things. In part, I'm thinking about sort of gradation. So we're, you know, for the sake of the conversation, we're holding some things as sort of being separate.
Yeah.
For instance, full liberation versus well-being. Right, this other orientation toward well-being,
right?
And the individual liberation versus collective liberation.
Kind of two big spectrums, really, right?
That's right. That's one way to view it, as two big spectrums. But my experience is that they're not two big spectrums, generally speaking. Mm-hmm. Although I analytically, I get that and understand like how that makes for an easy way to discuss.
Yeah.
Right, but I tend to feel like, you know, there's that liberation can have gradations in the way that we approach it, and so that the individual liberation is often on the way to collective liberation, and also this sort of what we might call, it's interesting, you know, just as a teacher myself and being in this place of like often teaching to students who are not really there for full liberation, like with any kind of specific intention or motivation on being fully liberated, and to feel a little bit better,
Yeah.
You know, and kind of deal with capitalism.
Totally.
You know, and make it, you know, totally. Maybe be a little bit kinder to themselves and their friends. And sometimes we can put that in a box and say, well, are we diluting the practices? And is this still useful or skillful? And, you know, and then on the other hand, if we can't even access any of that, it
yeah.
seems like very, very difficult to access full
for sure.
liberation if the heart and the mind and the body is so bound in suffering.
Yeah.
So I don't know if this is even really fully answering the question, but just to say that I kind of see it all on this spectrum, and it's not even a spectrum from sort of the point A to the point Z, but it sort of jumps, you know, and then there
mm-hmm.
are insights that arise, and then, like, you can take an insight which feels very in a more full liberation category, and then kind of
mm-hmm.
ping you back into just, like, trying to do
yeah.
self-care, you know, and it's
yeah.
sort of this more interesting. So that's been more my experience
yeah.
of it. And then just
yeah.
the one other thing that I'm reflecting on in terms of the community, like, for individual versus community, and
yeah.
and this kind of call to serve others or help others, you know.
Yeah.
Sort of interesting thing that I read recently that was just a study, like a, you know, some magazine that was printed, like a science or social research type of
mm-hmm.
study. And it was just talking about how, like, when you teach something, you know, it becomes more embedded actually in
mm-hmm.
yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually just something that we learn. And some of the martial arts traditions, they've known that for a long time, like, it will be built, you know, you're given something to teach so that you can learn it
yeah.
better. And so I feel like in some ways I'm often called to teach something, perhaps because I want, in part, to learn it better
yeah.
for myself. And so I feel like that's, I don't know, another way that the individual learning.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that piece. Certainly that's partly, I mean, I know that in myself, it's partly why I kind of try to bring the hardest topics I can to this group particularly, because I'm like, let's figure something out about this, because I'm not quite sure, you know. It's true for me too, you know, and in a way, the way you describe that, you know, as a non-linear but has steps kind of sequence, like, you can't do anything until there's some healing here. And it often seems like, I wonder if this is particular to a Western orientation that takes the individual to be the centerpiece of identity versus a culture that might take the communal, or like the family, to be the centerpiece of identity. But here I see folks like do a bunch of internal to the individual kind of healing work, and as that stabilizes, just as you're saying, then start to look outward and you know, be able to serve more. I wonder if that's different in cultures where, you know, you don't really exist, but your family exists as the identity. And so then that communal body would need some amount of healing before. I don't know how that works.
Does that also fit into the financial sort of structure or the economic structure of the society?
Right.
So, I mean, for instance, if you're, it's, you know, it's sort of like if you feel like you need to, we don't have much of a net, a safety net, so, right, it's just sort of like you feel like you got to work and make your money and kind of make sure you're all good and you're all fine, and then you can go out and take care of other people.
Right.
Like, in the community.
Right.
But if there was more of...
But you'll never be quite fine, so there's not much to give here.
Right.
Because it's so precarious. There is, right? So this is good. This is the pathway toward, sometimes we'll talk about, like, you know, Buddhism as being a kind of proto-socialism. It's very much the case, you know, in the Asian systems where lay people are giving vast amounts of their resources to support monastics.
I guess I can just imagine that then, that sort of, I think I heard you guys talking about put your own, you know,
right.
oxygen mask on before, you know, something about that. And
yep.
sort of like, it's hard for me to almost imagine being born, obviously, in a different culture where it's not this kind of institutional orientation.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting even be the first kind of.
Right. Yeah. Right. One of the ways that I can feel how deep that ideology goes is that I actually just can't conceive of it being otherwise. You know, like I can intellectually see that it's like that differently for other people, but they just seem like other people. Like I can't cross that gap at all in any experiential way. So now this is great, and some weave between around this sense of like what I still want to go back to in a way in our last few minutes. If there's anything anyone wants to add, kind of about the motivation piece is, I think the individual and communal piece is pretty resonant and kind of easy to grasp in conversations like this. I think there is actually quite a lot of wise reflection in our culture around the relationship of the individual and the group in terms of spiritual practice, partly because the Mahayana is the central framework, certainly in all of my Buddhist communities, even the ones who consider themselves Theravada and not necessarily Mahayana. Still, everyone talks Mahayana without it either admitting it or not. But a framework toward service and empathy is just built in to you know, to Western practice. And it's all over, it's subliminally all over Western yoga and Buddhism. But that doesn't mean that there persists in our practice a clear formal practice of motivation and orientation in the way that there is in the earlier practices. So I'm still curious about your thoughts on motivation as a cornerstone of practice, and a little bit like, practice totally works if you don't know why you're doing it, but I think it does something different if you know why you're doing it. And I think that partly because there are these traditions, particularly the Tibetan tradition, that that spend a huge amount of energy and time in the foundations of practice, very strongly trying to clarify exactly why you're doing this. And that clarifying that to a remarkable degree is necessary in some of the traditions before you go further. And so I'm curious about how much it's emphasized in some of the Mahayana traditions and what that might offer to us in a culture that doesn't focus on that as much. Any other reflections on your own motivation or what you find? Yeah, Lisa.
As I kind of reflect back, I remember pretty much always feeling like joy and freedom were possible and this suffering wasn't necessary. Mm-hmm. And
always meaning like in your life as a Dharma practitioner or like in your whole life?
Yeah, at least my whole adult life.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I wrote some poetry about it like when I was 18 or something that I remember. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know, I just kind of thought this isn't necessary, like joy and freedom is possible. And then over the course of my life...
That's such a good thing for an 18-year-old to write, right? This suffering is not necessary.
Yeah.
This is good going.
Thank you, yeah. The poetry wasn't much, but the idea behind it was really awesome.
It rarely is, but the ideas are often very good. They're often very good. Yeah.
And then there was a point where I was looking around and everything was fine, but I was so miserable and that didn't make sense. So I thought I gotta change everything.
Yeah.
And then at first it was that I was so miserable and I was desperate for relief. And my teacher in Idaho at the time, Anam Tupten student, she was really emphasizing compassion. And I'm like, yeah, all right, I just want relief from stress. And then over time, it just kind of grew this idea of compassion, and then it became pretty real that other people's suffering was hurting me. There was like this connection, mm-hmm. and
it wasn't separate.
Yeah.
That it was all connected. And so it much more now feels like whether I'm compassionate towards somebody else or myself, there's a real similarity and a connection.
Yeah. So I'm going to propose, as we close, a practice that's kind of a simplified version of a different kinds of practice that are like this, especially in the Mahayana systems, the Tibetan system, particularly. But the practice is in a certain way just like the imagination or the image that that your consciousness is the consciousness of the whole, we'll say world to be conservative. One could say all of the universe, but let's say the whole of the world, such that that the suffering of any individual person or animal or plant or system is like the kind of suffering that would come in your own body. So the earth is ill, you can perceive it as your own body being ill. And the caveat for this one is that if you're super empathic and this is going to send you into a death spiral of nervous breakdown, lots of boundary.
Green bubble.
Yep, the thing that saves you from that is that you don't exist. This is that linchpin in all the Mahayana practices, is that you can do this because everything is empty. There, nothing is actually solid. So there's no you here for that to stick to. So if that works for you, then include that in the reflection. If that doesn't work for you, forget about it for the moment and have a nice green bubble. But the reflection essentially is this. Everything in the world is my own body, the beautiful and the painful both. And I can care for it in the way that I care for my own body, which is both intimate and you know, deeply connected, but also doesn't have to be alarming. Like, you know, this week my tummy is not so well, I feel a little blecky after I eat. I'm not worried about it. It's just a little thing. And so I'm just like, oh, well, maybe I'll drink a little more water and, you know, do a little of this or that. I'm attending to it in an intimate way, but I'm not spinning out about it. But, of course, it's minor. If a big thing happened, I might certainly spin out about it. And so this practice is not to spin out, because you could focus on the big bad things happening in the world very easily, and there's a lot of momentum toward doing that. But if you can get the flavor, the idea of this would be not actually to do that, but to be bigger than it in a certain way. And this might be a place where the original reflection to think about not the world, but actually the vast extent of all of the cosmos is helpful. If all of that is you, then you know you could attend perhaps to the pain and suffering on this planet the way I'm attending to, you know, this cut that I have on my thumb right now. It hurts, I don't like it, I'm trying to do the right thing for it, but I'm actually okay as a cosmos in relation to this. And so you can improvise your way around this, but the direction is vast and compassionate at the same time, right? You're both everything and nothing, and therefore you can care for everything quite deeply and intimately the way you would care for your own body, but without attachment. You know, and again, if you get really lost in how much negativity is going on, like you're like, oh my God, I'm the whole world. I am, you know, I am the war in Syria, and I'm the war in this place. And you have to also remember that you are, you know, children picking dandelions in the south of France, and you know, butterflies everywhere, and you know, pieces of art being made all over the world, and every good thing, you know, you have to remember all that stuff too. And it turns out that there's kind of a mix and balance, of course. My thumb kind of hurts, but my other one feels really great. And I have to remember both, or else I'm unbalanced. So there's a reflection from the Mahayana that you can practice. If you practice it while you're moving around town, it's actually very nice. You just soften your peripheral field a little bit, and everyone who comes by is just, you know, blood cells hurtling along in the great body of the cosmos, or whatever you think of them as. And then when people want you to relate to them as individuals, then you come out of that, and you're like, hi, you know. So that's one of the directions that the Mahayana goes in, and it may be a hint for us toward the bridge both between individual practice and the sense of the whole and this mystery of emptiness. So we'll keep going in that direction the next few weeks. We'll look at some of the specific teachings around the orientation toward liberating everyone. We'll talk about bodhicitta, the mind of enlightenment, and emptiness, you know, as we go on. So thanks for being here. Thanks for starting off this new round with me. As of last Friday, so a few days ago, happy New Year, happy Lunar New Year of the Yang Earth Dog. So if that's a system that you relate to at all, you can enjoy leaving fire and landing in earth. You can enjoy dog, because who doesn't enjoy a dog? Dragon apparently doesn't really like dog, right? So if you're a dragon, you know, just stay humble this year. Dogs have it. And may it be a boisterous and friendly year. Thank you for your generosity of resources supporting this group to thrive through your own giving of money and presence and resources of all kinds that you can leave in the red box in there or give at the desk. There's a mailing list if you want to be on it. And see you soon. Take good care.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.